Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Joe R. Lansdale, author of the novel The Donut Region. Joe is the author of over 40 novels and numerous short stories. His work has appeared in national anthologies, magazines, and collections, as well as numerous foreign publications. He has written for comics, television, film, newspapers, and internet sites. And most impressively, he has won awards across genres, including the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Award, the British Fantasy Society Fantasy Award, and 11 Bram Stoker Awards from the Horror Writers Association. So, Joe, welcome back to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I always enjoy reading your books, Joe, because your books tend to be serious, but not too serious. You bring this level of humor, black comedy, that I think is sort of, and we're in such incredibly stressful times. I just love knowing you're going to deal with a serious issue, but you're going to make sure we have fun with this. Talk about that approach you take to writing.
Sure. Well, you know, I often use humor in my work, but I felt that it was essential for this one and when it's coming out and what it's based on. Because, you know, we've all just come off a couple of years of being confined to our houses pretty much and wearing masks and not being out in the public as much. So I think that all of this heavyweight stuff about that combined with all of the conspiracy theories and all the things going on in political and social life right now, I wanted to write about those things, but I thought, you know, I don't want to be too heavy with it because I think if I am, people will be turned off because they had enough of it, you know, enough of that stuff. But this way, you get that stuff across and you use humor. And sometimes the problem is people don't realize how serious humor can be. And they often confine something humorous or funny to, you know, it was just a good time. Well, if that's all you get out of it, that's fine too. I'm okay with just a good time. But I like to think this was a way of addressing issues and then making it palatable for people who've just come off this horrible period. And it's not over yet. It's just subsided somewhat, you know.
When I think about writers who tackle serious subjects with humor, the first writer I actually think about is Mark Twain. Are you a fan?
Yeah, absolutely. Love Mark Twain.
So in The Donut Legion, you do a deep dive into cults and conspiracy theories with its focus on a dangerous UFO cult in East Texas that has expanded its reach over the years. One of the things I think is interesting about this cult is you develop a story about a cult that isn't just about the cult, how they expanded the different aspects of life into this small fictional East Texas town called Maytown. They own businesses, they own chicken farms. Some of the leaders in a community are parts of this cult. I have to imagine that when you were writing this, that you were thinking about, and over the years, we think about Waco, we think about all these different cults where they hit the news when something tragic happened. So talk a little bit about your years of experience reading about these different cults and organizations like that.
I've always been fascinated how these cults build, you know, and I mentioned a number of them in the book, so I don't need to outline all of them. But what I will say is some of those that fascinate me the most are the apocalyptic cults and the ones that deal with flying saucers, you know, or aliens being part of the whole religion that they've developed out of this. It's sort of like Star Trek meets the Old Testament. It's rarely the New Testament. It's usually the Old Testament. And I just think people are very gullible. And in some ways, you know, you could say that all religions are a cult. But it's whether they're harmful that I think defines cult. And you see so many of these religions like this that are leading up to this apocryphal moment. And I think of Jim Jones, you know, and his cult, which first started out in a very positive way. It was trying to help people that didn't have money, that didn't have, I guess, people that were pushed to the side. He was trying to make it something they could engage in that would help their lives. And of course, that was appealing. But as time went on, he gradually took over more of their lives because power became addictive. And I think a lot of it is that, is how addictive power can be. And like QAnon, I think so many people just get involved in it because their lives become soap operas. They don't have enough things in their lives that interest them, that satisfy them. So here's something And I also find that it's so interesting that we have what I call the gullible stupid. It's people that in the most of aspects of their life are pretty normal. You know, they do their jobs, they take care of their families, so on and so on. But they will believe something as preposterous as these kind of things because they are what I believe I call the happily stupid, the people who decide I'm going to embrace this, not necessarily because it makes all that much sense, but because I want it to be true. And it gives them a community. It gives them some connection. And eventually, I think it's sort of like Kurt Vonnegut said, you know, be careful what you pretend to believe because, you know, eventually that is what you believe. And I think that that happens to some people. And then I think some people just step right into it, you know, full throttle and go, yeah, this is for me. And to me, it's scary. And it's primarily scary because there's usually one or two people that are manipulating this entire program. And it's all about power. It's all about money. It's all about influence. And that's scary to me. And so that's one reason it appealed to me to write about it.
So your protagonist, Charlie Garner, is 34, a former cop, a former private investigator, and currently a writer. Most importantly, he's still in love with his ex-wife. And he gets a visitation at 3 a.m. in the morning. And this is really what ignites his adventure to investigate the disappearance, eventually discovering the disappearance of his wife and her husband, which leads him to this cult. Now, did the plot for the novel come up before the main character? How do you work those two? Is it, I got a great idea for a character, let me build a novel around him or her, or is it, I got a great plot, let me build some great characters for this plot?
It can be both ways, but I very seldom have a plot, and I very seldom really have characters in mind. I just have a situational moment. And so I said, I wonder what happens if, you know, his ex-wife comes to visit him and she's got something for him. And that's all I had in mind. And as I started writing, what she had in mind developed or came out of my subconscious, and what happened to her came out of my subconscious. And the book's written in such a way that you can look at it in more than one way, you know, and it was fun to kind of play with that a little bit. And then from there, the book just took off. But I had no idea what she meant when she said those things, but there were a lot of things that I was interested in. There were a lot of things that I've experienced. There's a lot of things that I've read about. There's a lot of things that I heard about, and I just dropped the well into my subconscious and cranked it up. And that was what was in the water.
Now, there's an incredible amount of detail you reveal in the book about past cults and conspiracy theories. I understand that you don't actually have to do a lot of research, that you draw from your memory, from articles you've read, a lot of things you saw in the past. Talk about research versus just drawing from your memory and your subconscious.
Well, it's not that you don't research. It's just that you don't. I mean, in my case, I don't know I'm researching. I'm reading what interests me. And then those things get into my head. Now, I might have to go back then and get a specific from one of those if I remember that I'm going to. This is what happened, but I don't remember exactly when it happened or something like that. And if I need that or some other form of detail, then I'll go back and look at it and pull that out. But I've always had a very good memory. Not, you know, I'm not photographic or anything, you know, outstanding like that, but just have a good, decent memory. And a lot of the things I've read are kind of set back on the subconscious, and they kind of churn. And then one day they kind of surface. And then I guess I probably know subconsciously what I'm going to do, but I don't know it consciously. I just sit down and start writing. But the subconscious is your muse. There is no other muse than you. And I show up every day and the storyline just develops.
When you write your first draft, is there a point where you go back and look at the pacing, look at the structure and go in and make it? So do you go stream of consciousness as you start writing and writing and writing and writing and then go back and look at the structural elements?
I just do one draft and then a polish. What I do is I write, I polish as I go. And then when I get through, I just do a sort of, you know, look over, just an examination, and I'll find sentences I want to improve, or and I may add something in that I feel like I need to have to substantiate, you know, something that happened later that maybe is not built in as much. But I rarely have to do a whole lot of rewriting. I'm really good at that. My biggest thing is the proofreaders, who I love, because they can help me spell. They can help me with those things. I'm very stream of consciousness, though, you know, and I think it's in the prose to a great extent. I try not to let it overwhelm it, but sometimes people say, well, isn't that a run-on sentence? No, a run-on sentence doesn't actually make sense, but stream of consciousness has a kind of, it can be, jumping from here to there, but it has a kind of sense to it. And sometimes I'll write even more stream of consciousness as I'm writing it. And then when I get through that day, I'll turn right around and reread it and I'll correct. So in that way, I'm correcting as I go, but I don't do multiple drafts. That just depresses me. And I don't think the book gets better for me. It gets worse. It gets worse because then you have all these choices to make. And I don't want to do that.
Wow. Wow. You know, when I was on radio a lot, I'm still do the show at KZ, of course, you know, we would call people who were able to get the, when they were recording something, get it on the first take. We just called them first take John or first take Carl. People just have the ability to do it. But were you like that at the very beginning of your writing career? You wrote nonfiction. I believe your first article was published under your mother's name. So you've built an incredibly long career of writing. Was it as much stream of consciousness when you were writing fiction at the very beginning, or did that develop?
That developed. When I first started out, I didn't really know. I'd never met another writer. I never met an editor. I'd never talked to anybody in publishing. So I had no idea outside of just being a reader. And I wanted to write. And I've been writing ever since I was a child, you know. But I came up with different methodologies that I tried. And eventually, they led to what I'm doing now and have been doing pretty much since the 80s, the 1980s. We've been doing it this way. But during the 70s, I started in 73, nonfiction articles, begin to write fiction, which is what I always wanted to write in the mid-70s, begin to sell it sometimes between mid and late 70s. But it was just a miserable experience, and I didn't believe it should be that way. I felt like I've already have jobs I don't like, so I don't want another job I don't like that should be a job I like. Love, in fact. And so I gradually just quit doing all these multiple drafts and I had laying all over the place. And I would try to borrow from this and borrow from that. And all it did was frustrate me. And it didn't have an even tone to it. And I was looking for a tonality of voice. And I think what happened that really made the difference for me is different things I was reading in the late 70s and early 80s clicked with me as being similar to my voice and similar to the people I grew up. And once I found that, I could pretty much tell a story. And I tapped into my storytelling ability. I was actually muffling my own true storytelling ability that I grew up with my dad, who was a great storyteller, and my grandmother, and, you know, other people that I knew, some relatives, some not. And I said, this is my experience. And I don't know anything about New York or Los Angeles. At that time, I'd never been to any of those places. Now, of course, I've been many times and all over the world. And the writing gave me that opportunity. But what happened is I said, I'm going to write about East Texas. And I'm going to, at least most of the time, write in the voices of East Texas and primarily my own voice, which is East Texas.
So let's get to the cast of characters, the main characters who are like, they're like sort of, it's a buddy type of movie. You got Charlie Garner, who's, of course, the protagonist. And then you have his brother, Felix, who's a former football player, former psychologist, now a private investigator. Then we have Cherry, the shark lawyer that dates Felix, and then we bring into the mix Scrappy, which is an interesting nickname for one of your characters. So talk about building this cast of protagonists where you have a lot of zingers going back and forth. They crack on each other. They make fun of each other. So which brings that comedic element, that humor to the serious topic.
Yeah. Well, when I'm writing, like I was saying, I don't know these characters are in that story. I don't know they're there. And then they just start popping up. I didn't know he had a brother. And then I started writing and I thought, yeah, you know, he does have a brother. And then it's sort of like I begin to know who he is. And once I begin to know who he is, I begin to understand who his family was, who his past was. And then the others, I begin to think Felix, you know, having been a psychiatrist, would probably be attracted to people with some sort of education, some sort of, strength about themselves, although he was a lousy psychiatrist and really essentially got disbarred. But those characters kind of grew out of who would these characters be with? You know, who would they spend time with? And I think Charlie needed someone like Scrappy, who was totally different from his previous wife, Meg, And she is somebody that kind of comes out of nowhere, kind of has a humorous look at life, but you don't know if it's all humorous or it's just how she perceives things, which I think is a lot of it. She just sees it this way, and it's not funny to her, but for people looking at it, you're going, oh, that's funny, you know. So they develop naturally out of the story and out of the people I know. I borrow from people I know. I don't necessarily borrow everything so they know who they are. But there was a lady I knew who was very much like Scrappy, used to work in the same place I worked. And I only knew her a little and tangential, but there were little things that about her that never left me, you know, and it stuck with me. And I said, someday, I bet that comes up. And it did.
So was she a dental hygienist too? Hygienist?
No, she was not. But she had been, just like Scrappy had been. But she wasn't at the time, no.
So the big bad, why did you decide to have Cowboy, who's described as basketball player tall, huge, ex-convict, the enforcer for this cult of the managers, who are the enforcement arm of the cult? He has a pet chimpanzee.
Yeah.
And this makes Mr. Biggs, he has a sidekick. Talk about the creation of a villain with a chimpanzee sidekick who has some interesting moments as you read deeper into the novel.
Well, you know, when you get into a lot of these cults and you read about them, you find that they actually most often, frequently anyway, have enforcers. The ones that are the more extreme they are and the more extreme they become, they have people who do the dirty work for them. And I had read about someone who had committed a crime very much like Cowboy committed. And it stuck with me because it was such a terrible crime that I thought, how does a person like this live with themselves? And then you start realizing, of course, what you really already know is they aren't like the rest of us. And so it developed out of that. And the chimpanzee, Mr. Biggs, I'm a big Jane Goodall fan, and I majored in anthropology, but I didn't graduate in anything. So anthropology has always interested me, and apes. And you'll find that in Charlie when he's constantly correcting people from calling a chimp a monkey. He doesn't like that. And my kids will tell you that I do that with them. No, it's not a monkey. It's a chimpanzee, or it's an ape, you know. And so I just kind of put all my interests together and all these things that I had remembered, like this horrible crime. I think it's a way of getting it off my chest and to some extent off my mind, is to put it in the work.
Is writing like therapy to some degree?
I think it is. I think it is. I'm not overly conscious of it, but when I think about it, I think it is. I'm an extremely happy guy. I'm not a depressed person. I'm not. A lot of writers I know are depressed people, but I'm not amongst them. And I'm very fortunate for that. I think it's a combination of the way I was raised with certain chemicals that my body gave me, you know. It doesn't mean I never have a bad day or a blue day. Of course I do. And, but usually if I'm depressed, there's a specific reason I can point to. And I have friends that have chronic depression, and it doesn't always have a visible or understandable source. And it's a real thing. It's a real, you know, disease. And I respect that, but I'm also happy that I just didn't get that situation. You know, it came out much better for me generally as a person. So I think it's odd that my work can be sometimes very dark, but I'm not. But I've been through a lot of experiences in my life that I've seen some things that I'd rather not. I've known people I'd rather not have known now. And all of that, I think, goes into the books. And I think it is a way of putting it out there. And generally when I write about something, especially if it's been brewing for years and years, it ceases to bother me. It doesn't mean I don't remember it, but it doesn't have the same power that it once had. It's sort of like I've voodooed it. You know, I've moved out. I've said, there, that's it. I exercise.
So talk about the history of the cult, because in the book you use two characters to give the background on the cult. You got the former chief of police of Maytown, Grover Nunn, who's in his 70s, mm-hmm. His wife is deceased. they were in it. They got out of it. He gives background on it. And then you have Kevin, who worked at the Saucer Donuts. I'm looking for Saucer Donuts now when I come to East Texas, who worked at the same location that Meg worked at. So Charlie goes over there to get some background on Meg and when did she stop coming there. So it's interesting that you have a very old guy who was in the cult way back when and got out of it. Then you have the young guy, the high school dropout, who is still in it ostensibly, but is trying to plan his getaway from the cult.
Right. Well, you know, sort of that was kind of inspired, in fact, by Scientology, people that got out of it and people who said, you know, there's this and that about it. And a lot of people, you know, they're saying, well, this is true or it isn't true. But the important thing is that there are people who fled that cult that believe, some people call it a religion, pretty much they're often the same. He fled that. People have fled that cult because it was so dangerous, or they begin to realize how powerful it was. They begin to realize that they had grown up in it, how manipulated they were. And I've known people in marginal religions that were cultish who just one day woke up and said, what the hell am I doing? You know, and I've known other people that just get deeper and deeper into these things. But most of those have been more benign cults comparatively to something like this. And so it was based on people that fled cults. It was based on people who had been deeply involved in it. And I think there's a explanation somewhere in there, not so much an explanation, but a thought about suddenly, I think Kevin was saying he saw this window and he saw some light, where before he'd just shut the window and stay on his cult course. He saw the light and he pushed the window up and escaped. And I think sometimes that happens. It takes a certain moment. It's almost like being an alcoholic or any other problem like that. Sometimes you hit bottom and you come out of it. Other times, hitting bottom doesn't make any difference. You know, I've lost some very good friends to alcohol and drugs and even depression, things of that nature. And sometimes you come out of it or you find ways to deal with it or medically or psychologically, whatever. But if you don't, there's no way you can think outside that because the thinking has already been established for you. You've reached that point where you're no longer thinking because it conflicts with what you've been taught to believe to such an extent that thinking about it in any other way somehow violates what you've been led to believe is the truth. And so a lot of that went into it too, is that people I knew and people I've read about and marginal situations or similar situations. I'm a martial artist. I've been one. I've known martial artists who were practically in cults with certain martial arts schools and how they looked at life and how they looked at their instructor and stuff like that. And being an instructor and being a martial artist for 60 years, I look at that and I go, you know, that's not what it's meant to be or shouldn't be. And it can happen in any form, be it religion, be it martial arts, be it business. You know, there's all kinds of ways that you can be part of a cult and not even realize it and become to accept its statutes to such an extent that you can't let go of it.
And it makes me think about people who are involved with cult-like organizations who repress their own goals, their own dreams, their own desire service of that particular organization. And I've seen that personally. And what's sad about Kevin is he has dreams. He has dreams. And Charlie helps him a little bit with thinking about his dreams. So Charlie helps him reignite some of his dreams of being a comic book writer and even offers to help him.
Yeah. Yeah. I think sometimes that's it, too, is that you get the right lifeline at the right moment. You know, you had Kevin at a point when he was already having his tremendous doubts and had sort of turned the corner. But in my mind, what was happening is he'd already sort of done that. But the moment he sat down with Charlie, all of that became real to him. And he began to realize exactly what he was thinking. And he had been thinking about escaping, but he hadn't actually, I think, verbalized that until that moment because there was no one to talk to about it. And sometimes that what makes cults powerful is they isolate you from any other thinking. And so the thinking you get is just that belief fed back to you by other people who are, and you're feeding it back to them. And I think that that was part of what was going on with Kevin. He was peripherally in that organization anyway, but things happened to give him that window of light, as I was referring to.
So talk about the creation of Saucer Donuts. Do you have a particular love for donuts? And is that why you wanted to center the cult in donuts?
Well, I like a good donut, but you know, I, I've eaten one donut in 10 years, and I had it the other day in celebration of the Donut Legion. But I don't eat donuts. I don't. It's not that I don't like them. I don't eat them because I like them.
All right. So I'm going to ask you to fess up. I'll tell you my favorite donuts, and I haven't had. Well, I did have a couple of donuts recently, but before that, I hadn't had donuts in a few months. Round Rock donuts, the best donuts I've ever had, and I've had donuts all over the country. When you were eating donuts,
I hear that.
What were your favorite? What's your favorite?
Well, you know, I'm not saying I'll never eat another one again, but I don't make a point of it because there's so much sugar and I'm hypoglycemic and I'd be in the stars a lot of times. But my favorite was chocolate covered. You know, if it had chocolate on it, I was in. I like that, you know, and sometimes I liked ones that had like cream filling inside. So those were my two favorite. But I'd been known to eat just a plain old donut or a cake donut. When I was younger, my wife and I both, we would buy a dozen donuts and eat them, you know, just us. Because back then, you know, you're young, you don't gain a pound, you know, you're working in hard work and stuff like that. And, but later that's not very healthy. I think health is the main reason I don't have a donut a day.
I understand. I will tell you the last time I bought a couple of dozen Round Rock donuts, I had to, because I had my sister and her family visiting from Florida. So it wasn't me. They wanted those Round Rock donuts.
Well, they're famous. They're famous. And next time I go through Round Rock, I may be stopping in to have a donut. Because I think about every time I go by, I just pull in, don't do it. Don't do it. You know, the steering wheel, you're fighting the steering wheel. But the saucer donuts, really, it's funny. There was in Lufkin briefly, it wasn't there very long, there was a pizza place called Flying Saucer Pizza. And that kind of registered in there. And then there's a lot of donut shops. That's become like a thing, you know. And Nacogdoches has a lot of them. And I know a little bit behind the scenes about how that donut business works. And it's actually a little bit nerve wracking because the competition is heavy. And what people are willing to do to maintain that donut shop is kind of disturbing. And I just accelerated that and made it a bigger thing. And I thought, you know, if I was going to own a business, I would own donut shops. And especially if there's one in Maytown, but it mentions the fact that there's more than one. There are other donut shops elsewhere, and there are other businesses elsewhere. And of course, they're also tied into to all the money that people give to the organization. And it's like many organizations are religious, cultish. You end up giving of yourself. You end up giving all that. They want you to divest yourself of those things, but they don't divest themselves of those things. And so I thought the donut shops were a logical thing for East Texas, but they were also funny to me. The idea that you had flying saucer or saucer donuts, and that this was part of the way they sponsored their cult, was just humorous to me. And I thought very, very likely, very possible it could be done, you know, and would be done.
All right. I hope any future cultists aren't listening to this interview and come up with their own. So here's something interesting you wrote. Prophecies were given. An expiration day for life on earth would eventually be revealed, and all the true believers would need to pack their bags and rendezvous with the alien rescuers. For now, however, keep that money coming.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, a few years back, I can't recall the guy's name now, but there was he had a radio show, and he predicted the end of the world because of his math. He had done all this math out of the Bible that predicted when the end of the world was, and people believed him. Normal people, normal jobs, families, they got rid of their pets, they sold their goods, they got rid of their money because they just knew that they were about to experience, you know, the end of the world, but they were going to be pulled into heaven. And of course that day came and went, and they weren't, and now they don't have any money. They don't have jobs. They don't have pets. They don't have any of this stuff. And so this guy, of course, said, well, you know, I think I misplaced a 4 or 5, and I'll redo the calculations. And he did. And that date came and nothing happened. And then he said, well, maybe I don't know when after all. And so to me, that power of that was another thing I had read about that really affected me, that people were that involved in that belief that they were willing to give up everything, just the, you know, simple ways to take care of your family, and to do, because they really thought they were going to be sucked up to heaven, you know? And of course they weren't, and nor will they ever be.
So you're clearly an advocate for people, no matter what organization that they are in, that they continue to think independently, recognize the signs.
Absolutely.
Of organizations trying to force beliefs on you that maybe naturally, you know, this really doesn't make sense. And there's a, sort of this, I think, you know, one of the messages I see in the stories, sometimes you just got to pay attention to your common sense.
I think so. You know, I think that there's a lot of people, and I love Star Trek, but I think Star Trek in an indirect way is responsible for a lot of this.
Wait a minute. Wait. Well, that's sacrilege.
I'm a fan.
The original Captain Kirk, the original.
Yes, that's the one I like. But what I think, though, is it was so powerful in some people's lives that it helped develop this concept of alien contact more, and the possibility of it. And I think a lot of people embraced it almost as literal. And, you know, I'm not saying that that can't be possible, but I'm saying that they have taken that whole idea of alien contact, and it's grown, and it was always there. But really, when you think about it, a lot of this is tied up with like Star Trek ideas. Like, here comes this spaceship, it's going to pick us up and take us off this planet to some other place, which is a paradise, you know? And, I think a lot of that is that we were prepared to believe this more easily if you weren't a thinker. You know, if you're a thinker, you know how to enjoy it and know how great this is and know that it really does express some cool ideas, many of which, you know, have come to pass or will technologically. But I think for a lot of people, it was just such a relief from their lives because they were uninterested. Because they chose to not do what they wanted. They chose to do what was expected. And I think a lot of that primed people for that easiness to slip into these ideas of cults and these ideas of conspiracy theories, and people are turning into lizards. And there's actually people in the government that are lizards. All of that comes out of science fiction. I love that genre. I'm an absolute fanatic, but you know, you got to have some sort of detector built in that tells you that, yeah, you know, this is fiction. This is fact. There is fact in the fiction, things in technologically that can be developed, and, you know, space travel, whatever you have. But, you know, don't carry it too far without having some true evidence of such.
Well, you and I are of an age to appreciate the original Star Treks. But yes, I would offer up to you that maybe the another generation of that type of approach would be the people watch X-Files. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's always that too. You know, my son and I wrote X-Files comics, you know, so I love all that stuff. So I'm not trying to cut it down. I'm trying to say that I think that people that were desperate and looking for something, it could have been any kind of religion, but it happened to be that was more appealing to them because it's something they grew up with. They liked the idea of it. And if you weld that to religion, like, you remember Heaven's Gate, all the people, yes, wearing their little Nikes with a plastic bag over their head and a belly full of poison. That's got to be the strangest thing. They were waiting for the ship, literally. And when that didn't seem like it was going to happen, and the guy knew that they were going to be discovered, just like in most of these cults, he decided to get rid of them so he wouldn't look like the, you know, an idiot that he was. And these people just went along with it. Yeah, okay, it's changed. Now we're just doing it in spirit. Put a plastic bag over my head. Thank you. I mean, that's just so strange to me, you know.
But I brought up X-Files not because of the age generation, right? So with X-Files, you know, I watch a lot of X-Files. So they literally talk about aliens and waiting for the ship. And they, whereas Star Trek, you know, I watched it every single episode of Star Trek, didn't watch The Next Generation, but watched every single episode of Star Trek. It was just, this is 2,000 years in the future, and we're doing all these great things. But with X-Files, they're saying right now, there are a lot of, I mean, isn't that sort of like a conspiracy? It's a conspiracy driven series.
Yeah, but I think it's all connected. I think that, you know, when I was growing up, to find something that was science fiction or fantasy or horror on regular mainstream TV was almost impossible, you know. And when Star Trek came along, like Twilight Zone before it and Outer Limits and, you know, those kind of things, I think were rarities. And that's why we all latched onto them that liked this fantastic stuff, because I did. It led to my career along with other things. But I think that now we're saturated with it. And I think we're saturated with such an extent that people believe these things. I mean, there when Hastings was around, and my son worked at Hastings, but someone told me there were people coming in there for something to do with the zombie apocalypse, that there was something, some kind of candy that people could, I mean, really, people embrace the idea you'd eat certain candy and you were going to become a zombie, and that there was going to be the government controlling the zombies. And that's a story that can be convincing within the moment, but it shouldn't be convincing in your life after you put down the book or finish the film.
To what degree you think a lot of this is driven by not so much their board, and that could be one path, but either
that's just one thing. Yeah.
You have been very unhappy. Life isn't what you thought it would be. Then you begin to search for meaning wherever it may take you. Right.
Right. Right. You know, and I also think, and this is probably think I'm nuts here too, but I also think it's consumerism. And I think that in the 50s, when they started having the advertising as king, the idea was not to sell you something you needed. It was to convince you needed something you didn't. And I think you have that now. Even if people watch the Kardashians, they've got all of these incredible clothes and the money and the cars, and they haven't done anything, you know? So people think, they start to, why am I not entitled? Why do I not have this? So I think it's for some people, especially I think if you're young and you don't have the balance in your life with people telling you, this is a TV show and it's really not happening in spite of the fact that it's supposed to be a reality show. These things are often scripted, they're planned. And if you watch them the way they're shot, you can tell they've had to rearrange the angle, and which would have meant they had to do it over. And so things like that, I think, make people think that they're not worthy, because look at all these people living these lives. They're everywhere. They're all over television. There's all these shows and there's these really sophisticated people and there's these idiots, and they're all making money because, look, you see it. What have I got? You know, I got to go to work at the aluminum chair plant and I have to bring a bologna sandwich with me for lunch. So why don't I deserve all these things? Well, now, wait a minute. There's a religion that's offering me something far greater than what my life is or what it's ever going to be. So why not embrace it? Now, I don't think that's absolutely the totality of it, but I do think it's part of it. And, you know, I think we got advertising and consumerism to blame with it, and also the fact that we don't have people taught to have critical thinking anymore. You know, people are just, they're not even taught. A lot of times people aren't raised up, they're jerked up. And I think that you also have people that are just sort of abandoned by parents. You know, we got a lot of good parents out there. We got a lot of people who care. But you have all, if you get all these factors together, and unfortunately, I think they're far greater than we realize sometimes. Our population is far greater than it used to be. So you got more of these people. I mean, when I was growing up, a lot of people, they were happy to have a good job. They were going to be able to work at that factory for the rest of their lives. I mean, that sounded like a horror tale to me, but at least it had a certain amount of importance, and it had a certain amount of expectation that you were going to be able to live what we call the American dream. The American dream wasn't originally about being rich. That's been totally misunderstood. It was about being able to have a job, pay for your house, pay for your food, raise your family, and send your kids to college. That was it. That was the American dream. But now it's become being like the Kardashians.
So let's go back to the novel, because I want people to get a clear view of what you think people should be getting from the novel. I've sort of given my take on it. But so what would you say to people about your novel, what you're thinking they should get out of it, entertainment wise, messages wise?
Well, I think it's funny. I think it's got lots of action. And so in that sense, it is very much an exciting, fun read. But underneath it all, I think there's really only one other thing that matters, and that's critical thinking, and not to be misled, and not to lay all of your beliefs and all of your ambitions at the feet of someone else.
All right, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, but this is one of the lines I really loved from your novel about East Texas. And you love East Texas, so let me make it clear.
I love it.
You love East Texas, but you see it for all its good and all its warts. And so you write, around here, you say, God or guns, wave the flag or the Bible, you can get away with anything. Expound on that.
Well, I think that people are so taught that, you know, religion is the truth, and you can make that decision for yourself. I'm not a religious person. I don't buy that. I always feel like if you have to have religion to be a good person, then you're not a good person. So to me, you know, it's this whole idea that if somebody says, well, I'm religious, there's the Bible. You go, well, I can't contest that. I have to get behind that because that's the Bible. Somebody waves the flag. We have to go do this in the name of the United States of America and patriotism. It's not the flag. That's a piece of cloth. It's who's waving it and for what reason. And I think that that gets back to what I was thinking about before. It's critical thinking. I can get behind either one of those depending on the situation. I'm not religious. I'm not a Christian. But when Martin Luther King spoke, I followed because I understood what he was saying. And it wasn't just about religion. That was a way that he was able to pass it on to other people. I'm not saying what his view was or not or anything. But what I am saying is that he was actually making a point that was broader than follow me alone. It was that, you know, we deserve this, and we all in our own way and our own right need to look at civil rights. And that means black, white, what have you. But I also had people waving the flag and they sign up for things that we really shouldn't be doing, or at least you should have the right to think about that and not feel obligated to be patriotic when it's not patriotic. It's just you being a lemming. You know, you're just following it because you feel that that's your obligation. And what, how are other people going to think about me? That's a whole lot about how people do their business and conclude things, is like, how will my fellow church members think about me is if I question anything that the Bible says or anything that the preacher has said, or how do I people think about me am I patriotic if I question what's considered patriotic by this certain person? You know, I consider myself patriotic, and I frequently disagreed with our government, but I've never wanted to think this is the worst government or let's overthrow this government or anything like that. I feel like government at its best can be used for good and can listen to people. But I think we kind of slid away from that. And now you have people that are on the left and on the right that, you know, the right's just out to get the libs and the libs are out to get the conservatives. And I think it's hard to find that place in the middle anymore. I really do. I consider myself progressive, but I don't want people telling me what I should read on either side. And especially when the right and the left both hate the same things, you know, something's not right. You know, when they both hate Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, you know, Huck Finn and by Mark Twain did what he meant to do was make you think.
Right. So I'm going to close with this question. You've built a long career writing in multiple forms, multiple genres. What advice would you give to a young writer who wants to learn how to be a working writer?
For me, I at some point just decided I didn't want to do anything else. And I worked other jobs, but I wrote regularly. The only advice I can really give you is you need to love not just the idea of it, but doing it. You need to love books. You need to love to read. You need to be a critical thinker, and you need to sit your butt in a chair and write. I only write 3 hours a day. That's how I write all this stuff. I get up in the morning, I write 3 hours a day, and I do it as well as I possibly can. I care very much about how it sounds, how the language is, how the dialogue is, you know, the characters, all of that. But I don't spend every hour of the day doing it because I think it kind of muffles you eventually. I think you wear out. But you should show up, work hard during your time, be it 3 hours or eight, if that's what you want to do. But showing up and being a big reader, that's the trick. There's nothing else.
But isn't it important to live your life? Because that can be the source of ideas. Yes. So if you write all the time.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you don't want everything you write to have the stink of the library about it. I love libraries, but you want life in that thing, you know, and I've lived some life. You know, I've been very fortunate and unfortunate, and both of those things have gone into the work, or they've informed it in one manner, shape, or form, you know. And you got to live your life. That's why I write 3 hours a day. You know, I may not do anything significant with the rest of the day, but I'm experiencing, even if I'm just playing with the dog and hanging out with my wife, you know, we're doing something. And if I go to town and see other people, you get other ideas, or you see things going on, you know. And the other thing that you've got to have to be a writer, one other thing I didn't, is you've got to have true curiosity.
Jill R. Lansdale, author of The Donut Legion. I am a fan of Jill R. Lansdale. I'm a fan of this novel. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.